book, Britt Eklund writes, quote, "I am famous, but not for the reasons I still hold sacred." I think she means that the 25 films she has acted in hasn't contributed to her fame nearly as much as her marriage to Peter Sellers in the 1960s and her love affair with Rod Stewart in the 1970s. Her movie appearances include After the Fox, The Night They Raided Minsky's, Asylum, The Man with the Golden Gun, Royal Flash, Casanova Italian Style, and King Solomon's Treasures. At the end of Eklund's new book, she says her ambition for the future, outside the prospects of marriage, is to become one of the world's leading actresses. Her new book is called True Brit, and it's just been published by Prentice Hall. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Let me just refer back to that quote again. You say that you're famous, but not for the reasons that you hold sacred. Would you elaborate on that for us?
Yes, it sounds a little pompous, actually, when you read it out of context. I think, to make it simpler, I would have preferred to have, you know, had a direction in my career and have been known for that, but I didn't. And, you know, then you jump to the end of the book, and hopefully there is still time enough to not necessarily have that incredible, famous actress career, but at least to have the opportunity of doing things that I would like to do, which is, I would like to have my own TV show.
What kind of show? Variety show?
A series. A comedy.
Like
a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think America is ready for me now.
What were your visions of celebrity before you became one, and how was that changed, if at all, by becoming one?
It's very hard to say. I literally stepped out of my parents' home and into my married home and became an instant celebrity. It's, I don't think it's anything what you think it is. You think only in terms of what you actually see, which is a very narrow view of it. You don't see the problems that goes with not having a privacy, being written about when you don't want to. And you really have no control. It's not like, okay, I want it now, turn on, you know, cut off. You can't do that. And, you know, the effect it has on your friends and your family. Very often your family gets dragged into it when they shouldn't, and your children. But it's a responsibility. I mean, it really is. I think a lot of celebrities don't think that way.
What is an example of a time when you don't want to be in the newspaper?
It would be nice to be able to go to public places with public or non-public people without being always labeled, or the person in question, the new man in, or the new love of, or whatever. The press likes to read something romantic, scandalous, whatever you want, in everything, and that is not always the case.
How come you decided to write your new book? Because in it you tell a lot about people who you've been lovers with, about your ex-husband, Peter Sellers. Mm-hmm. It's a very personal book in that regard. And it's a part of a lot of people's lives that they might keep out of a book.
Well, in that case, you know, if I was going to think that way, then I shouldn't write at all, because I can only expose them by exposing myself. And I think that's what I've done. I think as much as I have written about the people that I have been involved with, I have written about myself as well. And not always in beautiful, glamorous overtones either. I think I've been fairly stark, realistic about what happened to me in my life. And the reason I decided to write the book in the first place was that I have lived most of my adult life in England. And I don't know if you know, or your listeners know, but the English press, or the European press, is really so different from the American press. There's no limit to what they can do. And there was very little of my life that has been private. So I felt that I could have the opportunity of filling in, you know, where or where they were misguided or didn't tell the truth, this was my opportunity of actually telling how it was.
Could this book have been written while Peter Sellers was still alive?
Certainly it was written. It was finished, completed in 1979. It was published, it was in the bookstore, July 7th, 1980, and he died July 27th, 80. So, oh yes, the book was available and written whilst he was alive.
Have you gotten any reaction from him or Rod Stewart or the other people who were mentioned prominently?
No, not really. I didn't expect it. I don't, they are, some of them are also celebrities, and I don't somehow see how they would approach me. I have met all of them, except I haven't met Warren, and, you know, it certainly has been very friendly. No flack.
Is it the kind of book where if you found yourself without knowing you would be at the same party with someone who you'd written about, that you'd have to leave or
No. I don't think so, because my feeling is, and the kind of feeling I get from talking to people, is that the book is honest enough to stand up. It's not just a kind of prying and gossipy into other people's life. It is into my life. And, you know, sometimes mistakenly the media has kind of said she's telling about Peter Sellers. The book is about Peter Sellers. It's not about Peter Sellers. It's not about Rod Stewart. It's about Britt Ekland. And, you know, if I had left anyone out, that would have been dishonest. And I'm not a dishonest person. I never have been.
From reading your book, I got the impression that one of the things that has happened to you is that you've had these really heavy and hot relationships with men who have initially really put you on a pedestal, and then something along the line changes.
Yeah, that's probably true. When I married Sellers, of course, I was very young. I barely spoke English. And I guess I was more of a possession than a person. And I was too young and too immature, too inexperienced to really understand what was happening to me. Years later, when I knew that it was a question of getting out, even though I loved him very much when I got divorced, but I just knew that if I wanted to stay an individual and to mature, I would have to go out and get my own life together. He was a very difficult man. It's almost like he, if you look at his life now, it's almost like he took very young girls and used up their energy, and then, you know, when that was, he went to the next one. I know that it was a very... It was very stormy, and it needn't have been at all. There was no reason for it. It could have been a very simple and very good relationship, but it wasn't.
Do you think that certain tendencies are exaggerated in relationships when the people involved are celebrities and constantly in the eye of the press? You know, like the is the pedestal taller and the drop further down, and is the kind of gap between you and he that you experienced since you were so much younger than he was even more exaggerated by his celebrity status and your newcomer status into the world of stars?
I don't think so. In our case, I'm sure that is the case with other people, but in our case, he really, I think he almost felt like he should model me into something, like I was some sort of putty and he could form his ideal person out of it, as far as an actress is concerned, because he certainly wanted me to be an actress. He when we, you know, first married, he never stopped me. He encouraged me. We did two films together. Then he kind of felt that he had the right, he owned me, and he had the right to take over my thinking. And if there was something that he was not pleased with as far as I was concerned, if it was a script that he didn't like, he wouldn't even show it to me. He would just mention like, you know, going out, see you later this evening. Oh, by the way, someone offered you a script, but don't worry about it. I didn't think it was good. See you this evening, you know, that sort of thing. Left me staggered. I didn't know. I mean, it was my life that he was treating so very lightly.
Did you see other women in the same kind of circumstance?
I think there has been women. I think there has been women in the same circumstance. I'm sure that maybe Bo Derek is to a certain degree involved with a man that she adores and who is obviously very knowledgeable, whether you like him or not. And maybe even, you know, many years ago, maybe even Raquel Welch, maybe she had that kind of relationship with her husband where he knew what to do and, you know, made her do it. In my case, it was different because although Sellers was an artist and a genius, he was not a manager. He was not a business brain, you know, he was a creative brain. And however much he wanted to, I don't think he could really know which direction I should be put into and, you know, which way to point me.
Well, the people who you mentioned have gotten a lot of criticism in the press for being like the victims of Svengali treatment in their career.
That's true. But you see, some women, and maybe men, but I can't speak for men right now, need that. They cannot make it without that kind of help or without that person in the background. I'm not like that at all. I have to make my own decisions. I have to stand up for everything I've done. I couldn't tolerate being, now at this point in my life, being that kind of manipulated. I wouldn't be suited.
When you're a celebrity, which you are, and you're involved with someone who's a big celebrity, there's so much attention being paid to you, both in the press, but there's always like groupies around and people writing the both of you letters. A lot of fuss anytime you walk into a room that isn't, you know, people of equally star status. Does that make things more difficult to be in that kind of limelight? Or, I wonder if you ever thought about, for instance, how many people's romantic fantasies were probably wrapped up with either you or your lover and what that does to a relationship.
I don't think at the time I was aware of it. It's scary because what happens is you don't try to live up to each other's expectation. What you try to do is to live up to the people's, the media or whatever, the fans, those people that fuss around. You try to live up to their expectation, which is pretty impossible because they already see you as, you know, something way up there. And inside, you are people. I mean, you are vulnerable people. It's a very difficult position to be put in. And I have much more understanding and better insight to what's happened to a lot of celebrity couples. I mean, I can see it now, you know. I can hear quotes they make. I can hear them coming from myself at some point in my life.
What do you mean?
Well, I was just reading in, I don't remember where, I guess People magazine, about Tanya Tucker and Glenn Campbell, which has nothing to do with us whatsoever, but she was saying something that I have heard myself say. She was saying she was 22 and he was 45, which was little more than Peter Sellers and my age difference, but, you know, close enough. She was saying things like, you know, I don't understand. He has everything in life, and I would give everything I have to make him happy just for a day. Now, I'm not saying that's a direct quote, because I'm not sure, I don't have the magazine in front of me. And I know what she means. I really, truly know what she means. She says that, you know, she will continue to love him and he'll be the only man in her life, and it's probably true, but you know, she probably went through with him very much what I went through with Sellers.
Was there ever anything like a self-help group for, you know, for young women involved with older star type men?
You know, I've thought about that a lot of times. I wish there had been. I wish I had had the background and the education to be more open and to say, you know, I want to save my marriage, but I'm going nuts. I think this man is suffocating me. Please, can I have someone to talk to? But I didn't even speak to my girlfriends. And subsequently, you know, it just went too far. It went to the point where I couldn't stay within that relationship any longer. And I also felt, maybe wrongly, that I couldn't walk back into it, even though there were many opportunities for me to do that.
You know, I don't know if you face this with your friends, but when I was reading your book, I said to myself, now, am I going to trust what she has to say about Peter Sellers, who I've always admired so much? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's when someone's an actor or a musician, you know them from their performances, and you have a very strong opinion of what they're like.
Of course.
And I wonder if it was maybe hard for you to share your opinion of what that person was like when you felt that they were getting out of control with people who felt that they already knew them very well through their...
It's a tremendous risk, you know. I mean, I could be stoned walking out of this studio. They could stand outside and throw stones at me and cans and everything. But the way I have described my marriage to him is the way it was. You know, I can't tell whether that's how all his other marriages were, but I have a pretty good idea. I have to take that risk. I can't lie. I can't glorify. Also, if I had gone in after he died and changed it, I feel that I would have been a hypocrite and I would have been probably attacked for that. You know, it's like racquetball. It's coming from all four walls, five walls. You know, you can't win. I feel better in myself, and that's really one of the reasons I wrote the book. I feel better in myself having told the truth, even if I destroy a myth. I mean, that's too bad. You can't destroy his genius. You can't destroy his films, ever. You can't destroy his artistry. But you can maybe destroy the myth of a wonderful, you know, loving man, because at times he was not that. He was a raving lunatic.
People always think that comedians and, you know, people who are very funny actors or actresses must be really funny at home, too. And, well, I frequently read that that's not the case, but that seems to be one of the things you're saying about him, that, mm-hmm. that things weren't about funniness and absurdity at home, that he was, what, very jealous? And
oh, yeah, jealous, possessive, depressive. Mind you, it must have been very difficult to have almost touched death and then to try to live the rest of your life as a perfectly normal human being. And the absurd thing, of course, was that he asked the doctor after the heart attack what things he couldn't do. And the doctor said, well, I wouldn't like you to swim a race, you know, or to take up tennis or, you know, to a fast game of tennis. And it made him totally depressed. I mean, he never played tennis in his life and wasn't going to. And the same thing with swimming. I mean, he very moderately, you know, plowed through the pool, but there was certainly no vigorous swimming. But just the thought that he couldn't made him depressed.
When most people split up with someone who they'd been with, say one of you's on the East Coast and one on the West, you're not going to run into each other unless you're in the same profession. But when you're in the same profession as someone who you'd been with and then you end up going to see their movies, there's probably never the same kind of distance.
I stopped seeing his movies, I guess, really, after a couple of years after our marriage broke up. I just, I was too affected by the personal side of it, and I don't think that I would have done, I don't think I would have done his work justice, you know, discussing it with someone. So, although there was a period when he made perfectly awful films, and he knew that. But I didn't feel that was fair, and so I just didn't watch them. If people asked me, I said, no, I'm sorry, I haven't seen it, which is far better.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Britt Eklund, and she's just written a new book about her life, which is called True Brit. You write about some of the roles you took after you broke up, and you said you needed money, and there were roles that you might not ordinarily have taken.
I was very careful through my marriage, and of course it was a lot of his doing too. I mean, the thought that I would appear even with a bare back was more than he could, you know, stand. So those kind of things were taboo. But after we broke up a couple of years later, I just, you know, by no fault of my own, I might add, I found myself totally broke and owing a lot of money with a young child. I didn't receive any support. So, you know, I just faced the fact that I have to support myself. I have to pay my bills. I'll do anything. I mean, short of pornographic movies, but, you know, anything. And I did anything. And 10 years later, people say, oh, how could you? And it's just too bothersome to sit down and explain, listen, you know, if you've ever been broke and you've been faced with more bills than you've ever seen in your life, and you really aren't trained to do anything else but what you do, you have to do them. You just have to, you know, close your eyes, grit your teeth, and go out there and do it. And then try to do it with as much dignity as you possibly can, which is hard, you know, very difficult. For me particularly, because my life had been kind of, you know, regular and normal, and although my marriage was difficult, that had nothing to do with my professional side. And I had a very 50s type of outlook on life, and I was very moralistic. And suddenly I had to throw all that aside and, you know, think about money.
Which films do you put in that category?
Oh, I did the film called Percy, about an obvious transplant. I did the film with Michael Caine, although that film really put Michael Caine back on the map again. He hadn't really done anything much for a couple of years, not really since Alfie. You can hear I go way back now. It was called Get Carter, and it was an excellent film. He was absolutely superb in it. But I had to, you know, take my clothes off and really be something I'm not. You know, I never looked at myself as a, you know, sex symbol. And now, at this age, I think it's thrilling. But then, you know, I felt I was a comedy actress, you know, an actress. And suddenly there I was in black stockings and garter belt and the stereotype 60s, early 60s type doll. And they were very nice to me, actually, when I shot that film. They were very thoughtful, and they closed the set because they knew I had never done anything like that before. But it was still difficult, you know. It was very difficult.
You think the meaning of appearing naked or partially naked in a film has changed now?
Oh, sure. I don't think it has the stigma that it had in the 60s. People were still so puritanical about everything, absolutely everything. And on top of it, because I was Swedish, you know, I felt like I had a double cross to bear, you know. But I did it, and I survived, went on. But it somehow leaves you with something. I don't know, I can't pinpoint it, but you know, once you've taken anything, the tendency is to, not if you're broke necessarily, but, you know, if there's an offer and it's okay, you tend to do it rather than not to do it.
And what are some of the expectations people have of Swedish blonde beauties?
I really don't know, but I walk into a studio or, you know, whatever, and I can see people going, you know, oh, I see. Almost as if something is written across my body or my forehead, which I really don't know what it is. I mean, maybe they have amazing secret fantasies or expectations and I fulfill them, or I don't. I really don't know. I can't imagine what it is. No one would actually sit down and say, you know, I was dreaming about you last night. And they don't do that. They just kind of look at you sometimes with amazement.
I'm talking with Britt Eklund, if you're just joining us, and she's just written a new book called True Brit. you write about, and I'd like to talk about a little bit, your relationship with Rod Stewart. How did you both meet?
We met at the concert. He was touring the United States with the Faces, which is the group he was in. And I went with a friend to see the show, and you know, you sort of hang out in the green room and have drinks before the show, and you see the show, and you go back and do the same thing again. And it's a lot of hanging around until they, the group, decides what to do and where to go. And I walked in there, and I wasn't in an optimistic mood. You know, I wasn't in the mood for anything, but they insisted that I go out. I'd broken up from Lou, and I really wanted to be on my own. And I really took one look at him, and I just knew there and then that something would happen. It would have been better maybe if it had went slower, you know, more steady. But it didn't, you know, it kind of really exploded in the night instantly.
Had you known his music at that point?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. And he was very known in England, and he was a very kind of, they had a kind of cute, rowdy, pretty little English pop boy type reputation. You know, they were a very cute band. They all looked alike with little shaggy heads and scarves, and they were known to be very rowdy on stage and throw witty remarks at each other and drink, and you know, they were cute, you know. And I'd seen him around London in parties and things. I knew of him.
What are some of your reactions to how rock is different from the film industry, you know, and the people who hang out in it, and you know, like what parties are like and what status means?
I think that it's hard to compare the two, because they really have nothing in common whatsoever.
Money and glamour in common.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean, money and glamour doesn't make a party. you know, movie parties are, and I'm not quoting myself now, I quote the papers, they're this, like A, B, and C parties, you know, which is all so pseudo-socially to me. I mean, it's, you know, I just don't understand it. I think it's kind of sick. I don't think that exists in rock. If you're a musician, you're a musician. And I think they are more rated on their craft than on their status in Cashbox or Billboard, whilst movie stars are always rated on, you know, the latest television series, the latest movie. I think that rock really had a supreme peak, I mean, above almost the movie industry, for about a year and a half maybe, in the mid-70s, 76, 77. And, I mean, now, you know, according to insiders in the rock industry, it's fairly low. You know, the contracts being offered artists are not anywhere near as substantial as they were. You know, the sales aren't as good, groups aren't selling. You can tell them, there's no one touring anywhere. Whilst the movie industry, of course, never plummet. They always, I mean, it's good or not so good, but it's never bad. And I guess that gives people, even people that aren't good, talented, gives them the power to always be in there. You know, always stay at a certain level, whilst the rock people just go down, disappear, and are on the unemployment list.
The whole groupie scene seems like it would be a lot more intense in rock.
Yes, I think in the movie industry, you call them fans. I mean, you know, there are some pretty, you go and do things, you do television appearances and things, there are some pretty weird people waiting to take your photograph or have your autograph. Equally strange in the rock scene. I don't think they differ that much. They the motive doesn't differ. It's just the form they choose. Some choose music, some choose movies.
You know, what I've also wondered, in movies, there's a lot of actresses. I mean, you know, it's mostly men who are directors and studio owners and producers and things like that, but there are a lot of women actresses. And in rock, predominantly, the bands are male. And I should think it might be a little more difficult to be a woman in rock circles at times.
I think that a woman who is actively taking a part in the rock scene has to be pretty tough. I think she has to forget what she hears, you know, kind of put blinders on and be slightly deaf with a loud voice. They can be pretty crude, you know, and I don't think it is to offend anyone. I think that's just the way they are, and they're not going to change for anyone. Whilst movie people, they really have to. You know, their image is not four-letter words and all-night drunken parties or whatever you want. I mean, I'm sure that's in the past anyway. Their images are a little more carefully groomed, whilst it's quite all right for a rock star, even a female rock star, to appear disorderly or badly dressed or unkempt, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Every rock band has like two or three songs in their repertoire about the difficulties of being on the road and staying in one hotel after another.
Sure.
What are some of the pressures that it puts on a relationship?
It's almost impossible. I've been on the road a lot. And I went because I obviously was in love with him, but I also love the music. And I didn't go because I wanted to be a backstage, you know, backstage Brit or whatever you want to call it. I was never backstage. But the pressures are when you get outside the metropolitan areas, you know, places like Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, where the traveling is difficult. The hotels are not first class. The fans are obviously stronger because there is much, you know, the amount of the fans might grow because there is nothing else to do in that particular place. Little things that people say, oh, how could you, you know, room service, you know. You have no idea the importance of room service at night after a gig. I mean, that is what the whole thing is about, room service, you know. If it's not available, you go nuts.
Mm-hmm.
You really go nuts because your life is usually traveling the latter part of the day, arriving, unpacking, getting ready, going to a gig, performing for an hour and a half, and then room service or, you know, a restaurant or something. And in many of those places, there is nothing. And there is nothing else to do either. They can't go out because the girls or the boys or the men or the women, whatever, are sitting out there, preventing them from having any form of relationship with anyone outside the hotel room. It's pressure, tremendous pressure, and sometimes, you know, it's like a pressure cooker. It has to go somewhere, and that's, I guess, where the televisions go out through the window and the breakfast trays end up on the hotel corridor. A lot of it isn't justified, but I personally, and I'm only speaking for myself, can understand some of the pressures because I have seen them.
You're referring to a real incident that happened when you were
traveling with the band. Usually. But I'm sure you read about it too, and people have heard about how they wreck hotel rooms. And, you know, a lot of that, of course, is publicity and hype, and, you know, a lot is hype. I mean, a lot, particularly in the rock world, is hype.
Are you thinking of something in particular that happened?
No, because, you know, when you talk about Rod, you talk about a real talent. There are a lot of unreal talent on the road who are just built up and have to be kept in a little box until they let out on stage and then put back in the little box, because if anyone really saw the person, they would die. You know, so I mean, there's hype in everything, but particularly there.
A lot of fans of musicians, and I guess particularly singers, have this fantasy when they're sitting out in the audience and listening to this love song that, gee, what would it be like if that love song was really getting sung for me? And I've always wondered what it's like for someone who's the lover of someone up there singing the love song, and if you experience that feeling, or whether there's all kinds of other things that enter into that that would prevent the true complete satisfaction of that feeling.
No, I don't think so. It's a real amazing feeling to listen to a song and to know that the words in the song were words that were told to you, not just, you know, before they went on stage, but many times earlier in your life, you know, before the song was even written. It's an amazing feeling. A writer, I can really only talk about Rod. Well, I did know Carole King quite well because when I was living with Lou, of course, he was her manager. But I know that with Rod, he would use a lot of situations around him and put them into a song. So people, you know, like You're in My Heart, people say, well, why Dutch? Well, the song is not exactly about me. I mean, it is about me, but Swedish doesn't rhyme with anything, so you can take liberties and make it Dutch or whatever else happens to rhyme with it, as long as the meaning of the song, the feeling of the song, is about that person.
Do you feel you watched him be changed by the adoration of so many thousands of people?
Almost definitely. Yeah, I have. I don't know him anymore. You know, I have no idea what he's doing or what direction he's in. He seems to be pretty much low profile, whether that's by choice or not, I don't know.
You sued him, I think, for
$12.5 million.
Mm-hmm. Was that, you weren't married, so that was what we now call palimony, right? Mm-hmm. What were your premises for doing it?
In my lawsuit, I think my lawyers said that I had been instrumental in bringing him to the kind of position he was in when we split. That a lot of my own experience and my past, the fact that I was known, I was an actress. I'd given up my work, and generally stood by his side when he kind of reached the super peak of his career, when he really became famous in the United States.
Did you win?
It wasn't a question of winning. I felt the lawsuit was probably the only mistake I really made. The only one that I feel good enough about to admit, you know, I feel that it's good to admit it.
Why was it a mistake?
Because I don't really, my beliefs are not in that sort of a thing. I think there must be other ways of settling whatever it is to settle. I also feel, you know, that I feel that he could have been more understanding. He could have not been such a coward and such a little boy lost, but he was. And there was a lot of circumstances that surrounded that, and it could have been avoided. You know, it really could have been.
What do you think of the palimony suits that have been filed subsequently? Do you think the premise is sound?
I think that each case has to be based on its individual merit. I don't think you can just throw them in one basket and pull one out. If you live with a man, whether you're married or not, you have no profession, you are in every sense of the world his wife, then why not treat her as a wife? I'm talking from a judicial point of view. I mean, where's the difference? The piece of paper, her love wasn't less, or his love wasn't less because they weren't married. I think that, then don't award the wife a whatever you, what is it called when you're not the pal, alimony. Don't award her anything either, you know. I mean, what's the grounds of awarding your wife anything? I'm talking now about children that don't have, I mean, couples that don't have children, okay? Because that's a whole separate thing. I think there has to be a fairness. It just has to be.
The other side of that is that if you want some kind of legal understanding, a legal contract, why not get married or draw up a legal contract?
I think also we live in an era where everyone is sick of being free and freedom, man, freedom, you know, space. I want my own space. I think everyone is sick of that. I think people really want to meet, establish a good relationship, and then cement it by marrying. I think it's not so important, that freedom thing anymore.
What happened to your career when you both split up? Was it affected by the separation?
Oh, yes. I was broke, you know, when I split up with Rod, I was broke. It was very difficult. I was lucky, though, at the same time, because I did two movies for television that just happened to... I just happened to fit them, you know. One was called The Great Valindas, which was about, the famous wire walker, Carl Valinda, and his family. I played his daughter. And, you know, he was German, so that made me suitable. And the other one was called Ring of Passion, where I played a Czechoslovakian movie star called Annie Ondra, Stephen Macht played the part, the fighter who fought against Joe Louis. Well,
sorry, I can't
slight,
help you.
Slight brain damage here. But after that, there really was very little, because, you know, my kind of, whatever you want to call it, actress status or whatever, is really very much dependent on being visible, you know, being available. And I wasn't.
Do you have any best and worst examples of the kinds of press coverage you were given or your relationships were given?
I think that the worst ever was during my time with Rod. The most worst. Is this such a word? The most worst?
It's all right.
I just made it. Was when we broke up and I sued him. I mean, not only was I emotionally wounded, but here they pinned all these tags on me. They made me out to be the most revolting human being I would ever want to read about. And I knew it wasn't me. I knew it wasn't me, but I couldn't say anything. The best press coverage, and I don't know really, but the feeling I have is probably now, because I'm not pretending to be anything, and I'm not making up anything, and a lot of it is behind me. And I really have grown into what I hoped, and what I knew was there, you know, way back when I split up from Rod. So that's probably a good comparison.
Does the press treat you differently when you're on your own as opposed to when you're in a relationship, and when it's like the relationship that's getting the coverage?
In my case, no. I think the press has always treated me, period. And then if there was a relationship, then that was a bonus. Mm.
Have you ever seen yourself as a sex symbol?
No, but only for very simple reasons, purely physical reasons. You know, I'm not a huge person. I never felt I had the attributes a sex symbol should have. In other words, you know, curves everywhere. But then maybe there is a different kind of sex symbol. Maybe there is someone who is, you know, more my size. Now I think it's fun.
What's fun about it?
I think it's fun, you know, I think when I was younger, I was afraid of it, you know, afraid of the label. Now I'm quite flattered. I think it's quite interesting to be me, having gone through what I have done, and having that label. I can use it.
How?
I can use it to my advantage if I wanted to. I don't think it hurts me. And you know, as we said before, if I ever got my own TV show, my own TV series, I think that could be quite fun to take the mickey out of, you know, to use that image and make fun of it rather than, you know, take yourself serious, which I don't tend to do anyway.
Mm-hmm. You've done some TV episodes recently, right? You've done some Fantasy Island episodes?
Yeah, I've done Fantasy Island, Love Boat, those kind of things.
You know, I've always wanted to ask someone this, but...
Okay, go well, ahead.
On a set of Fantasy Island, does everyone take their roles really seriously, or... Because they've always seemed to me to be so campy, you know?
It's hard to tell, really. You know, when you come in to this very close-knit family who... It's almost not like an ensemble play. It's like each person plays their role, and then they put it all together in the editing room. They, you know, I really can't say anything because they have always been very gracious and very kind and very thankful every time I've been on the show. And of course, you know, Hervé Villechaize, I worked with way before he was a star. He was in the Bond film I did.
Oh, really?
And we became very, yes, in The Man with the Golden Gun. He played the little villain, and I mean, Christopher Lee played the big villain. And we became very, very good friends. And, you know, he was a wonderful person, wonderful human being.
Do you feel like you've learned lessons about how to live since
sure.
since you've been involved with all of this?
Oh, yes. I mean, only a fool at this point wouldn't have, and I could not possibly sit here admitting to be a fool, because I'm not. You know, whether I've learned something I can use... let's say in my next relationship, I'll see then, but I know I have. I'm treading very carefully right now.
Do you believe in marriage at this point?
Do I believe in marriage?
Yeah.
Almost certainly. Most certainly. I think marriage is a very necessary institution, but I think more awareness before you go into it is necessary, because they don't last. No one cares, you know, that's the problem. No one really cares to keep it together, even if they wanted to. Or else maybe people marry for the wrong reasons.
So what's the point of getting married if they don't last?
Well, I only speak for myself. I mean, that's, you know, I have waited. I have only been married once, and I'm taking my time.
Have you met any young actresses who you feel are in a situation now very similar to the one that you were in when you were 21, first getting started?
No, because... the industry today is designed differently. You know, you can be a young actress guesting on a show, and then the next day you have a contract and you got your own show in television, that is. On the screen, I think the format they have been keeping the last 10 years or so are pretty much the same. No one is upcoming overnight. Maybe Brooke Shields, but I think she's a very... separate case altogether. Most actresses you see on the screen that are just discovered, you will find have worked very hard in summer stock theater, done small films, been abroad, you know, done a whole variety of things before they got the big break. And also, the same actresses that were in the lead in the 60s are still in the lead in the 80s. You know, I don't know what that means, really. It might just mean that they are the best there are, and no one else as good has come up.
So is anybody suing you for your book?
Nope.
Think anybody will?
Nope. There is no reason to sue me. I have not committed any criminal act, nor have I spilled any state secrets. Or see, there is no reason to sue someone unless they are saying something that is not true. And since what I have said is true, they can't sue me. They wouldn't want to. Why?
Oh, well, it's kind of fairly common when people write about other people that one of those other people...
Yeah, but they
sues.
Only write because the author... Okay, let's say... I know what you're saying. The author has weathered his own opinion. He said, well, I think so-and-so is a real stinker, blah, blah, blah. But I haven't done that. I've just said, this is exactly how it happened. Then it's up to you. If you think he's a stinker, well, then that's fine. That's not my problem.
How would you feel if a former husband or lover wrote a book and you figured prominently in it? Would you be comfortable with that?
As long as he's truthful, yes. As long as he's perfectly truthful, I would feel fine. You know, because that's what I have been. And that's the only thing I could tolerate.
Well, Britt Eklund, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Terry.
I've been speaking with Britt Eklund, and she's written a book about her own life, and it's called True Brit, and it's just been published. It's 5 minutes to 5 o'clock, and that about does it for this afternoon's Fresh Air, and I'd just like to tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon. At 2 o'clock, my guest will be Michael Arlen, who is the person who writes about television for The New Yorker, and he has a new book of essays about television that we'll be discussing when he joins us at 2 o'clock. And then at around 3, I'll be with photographer Elliot Kaufman, and he has a new book about diners. He's traveled all over photographing diners, many from our area. So we'll be talking about how diners look, diner architecture, and what's served inside when he joins us tomorrow. John Zwed will be here at 3:30 for his weekly review of new jazz releases. At 4 o'clock, Nick Peters will speak with the person who edited the Theodore Dreiser book Sister Carrie, or I should say perhaps unedited it, because the version of Sister Carrie that was always available has been a highly edited version, and a version much truer to the original has just been published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. We'll be hearing about it tomorrow at 4. And then at about 4:20, we'll hear from novelist Toni Morrison, who recently paid a visit to WUHY. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, and I hope you can join us then. The technical director for today's show has been Jay Goldman. Contributing today was Debbie Sackner. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer of the show is Danny Miller. And my name's Terry Gross. I'd like to thank you for listening and hope you have a terrific evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.